a suffering is here. Life is Skittles and life is beer. I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring. I do, don't you? Of course you do. But there's one thing that makes spring complete for me and makes every Sunday a treat for me. All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide. The sun's shining bright, everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We've gained notoriety and caused much anxiety in the Audubon Society with our games. They call it impiety and lack of propriety and quite a variety of unpleasant names. But it's not against any religion to want to dispose of a pigeon. So if Sunday you're free, why don't you come with me and we'll poison the pigeons in the park. And maybe we'll do in a squirrel or two while we're poisoning pigeons in the park. We'll murder them all amid laughter and merriment, except for the few we take home to experiment. My pulse will be quickening with each drop of strychnine we feed to a pigeon. It just takes a smidgen to poison a pigeon in the park.
You're listening to Ink Studs on CITR 101.9 FM. This week I'll be playing an extended interview I did with local underground comic legend George Metzger. You can find his work in such wonderful titles as Truckin' Comics, Moondog, Moo, as well as a local anthology of underground goodness back from the 70s, Fog City Comics, which featured George, as well as Rand Holmes and Marv Newland. And as a little side note, was published by the Georgia Strait. George is something of a legend in Vancouver, and we all have a lot of respect for him, a lot of respect for the work he did. I hope you enjoy. It was a really great conversation. Part two of this interview will be featured on inkstuds.com. It's a pretty lengthy conversation overall between the two, but I think you'll get a lot out of it and a lot of interesting stuff.
Train, pound cocaine, Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and know that notion just crossed my mind. This old engine makes it on time, leaves Central Station about a quarter to nine. It's River Junction at 17-2. At a quarter to ten, you know it's traveling again. Driving that train, pound cocaine, Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and you know that notion just crossed my mind. Trouble ahead, the lady in red, take my advice, you'd be better off dead. Switchman sleeping train 102 is on the wrong track and headed for you. Driving that train, pound cocaine, Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind, and you know that notion just crossed my mind. Thank you. and you know it's the end. The fireman screams and the engine just gleams. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And you know that notion just crossed my mind. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And you know that notion just crossed my mind. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, trouble behind. And you know that notion just crossed my mind. Driving that train, I'm cocaine. Casey Jones, you better watch your speed. Trouble ahead, you know, trouble behind. And you know that notion just crossed my mind. And you know that notion just crossed my mind.
This is George Metzger, is our special guest today. We're sitting at my kitchen table, one of my ongoing kitchen table interviews. The fellow we're just talking about, Patrick Rosenkrantz, he joined us for a kitchen table interview. Josh Simmons, and a whole bunch of other folks. I like doing the kitchen table interviews. It's like, it's casual, it's relaxed, I don't have headphones on.
You don't have to lean into a mic every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't have someone yelling at me from outside the studio, not like
knocking on.
Now they can't stop me.
Yeah.
They never have problems with what I say.
No.
CITR 101.9 FM, Ink Studs.
101.9 cable as
cable.
Well. That's how you can get it out here. You got to plug it into the cable vision. I'm the only one that calls it cable vision anymore. My friends give me a hard time with that.
On the wireless, dog.
On the shortwave.
So, George, you're one of Vancouver's elder statesmen in comics. Is that okay for
you? I'm certainly elderly. You know? I just turned 69. So
all right. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Mazel tov.
Yeah.
You've been involved, you've done comics, when you got started, 1963,
I started drawing comics when I was a kid. Yeah, because I learned to read. From comics, actually, you know. I mean, well, I'm Dick and Jane, but my reading really improved by reading Looney Tunes and Walt Disney stuff. Cool. And I read the news and the Sunday newspaper funnies too, and those are things that got me first, really. But when I was in my teens, I was drawing comics, you know, just for myself, you know, and making them and stuff. And I'd be embarrassed to show anybody any of that stuff now. And writing. Robert E. Howard and Lovecraft stories, you know, too. Stuff like that in English class. Although I look really busy in my English class. No, I was writing Seven Blunder stuff.
So like your own fantasy stories.
Yeah, no, I got started a long time back doing that stuff.
Whereabouts were you?
At that time, well, California. I was born in the Midwest, but they brought me out here to California. Mm-hmm. When I was about 6 or something, and we ended up in Northern California, up in the Gold Rush country. Pretty back of the woods, you know, and stuff.
Oh, that's
It was interesting. I like the historical part of it, but that's not what we're talking about. It was when I'd go down to the junkie store down in the slummy part of town and buy old comic books and Frank Yerby pulps, you know, and stuff like that. I did a story about a little duck who goes into a comic book store.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah.
The physical comic book store was in San Jose, California, right near the campus, and that's exactly what it looked like. Anybody who ever was in there would recognize it. But the time period and the people that are in it are from my childhood up in Oroville. The sleazy guy, you know, behind the counter looked like a sleazy version of a of a guy on TV called Boston Blackie.
Oh, yeah.
Thin mustache,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And this was a weird place because it was a secondhand store and there was hardly anything in it except in the back room there were comic books on one wall and these paperbacks on the other wall, see? And there was hardly every... I remember once seeing a washing machine in the front room. But it was, I think, it was just a hangout for this guy and his buddies. That was about it.
In the story, you're going back there, or the young duck is in the back room, voraciously consuming comics, and there's the... I almost get the feeling like the other characters are like what we have nowadays with the speculators, almost. So they're just, they're not there for the joy of it, they're just...
I don't know. I just put in other collectors who... didn't want to see somebody else coming around who might grab something, you know, that they're looking for or something like that. I don't know. It's just I just put it in there.
So some of the earliest comics that you were exposed to were like Looney Tunes, you were saying, and
yeah,
was there newspaper strips and things that you?
Prince Valiant and Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and stuff like that, which I started collecting at some point. Also daily strips. I collected stuff that nobody knows about it much anymore. Casey Ruggles by Warren Tufts, which is a Western strip, which I really liked a lot. However, I collected Dick Tracy, too. Mm-hmm. However, my parents decided that comics were not what, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like, in the book, in the comics book story, I had to go out and burn all that stuff.
And,
you know, I was right back at it within a week, you know. So, you know, they gave up on that. But, you know, comics, you know, no, that's you know, you're getting older now. You've got to put a lot of stuff away. I wanted to be an illustrator. I wanted to draw.
You're still not over comics.
Was your mom like a housewife or was
no? She was a librarian. In fact, she was the head. She went to librarian school, and she was in a librarian in Chicago. Legs Diamond came into the library once
really?
Borrow a book. The bookie joint next door was shot up once. You know.
Oh, yeah.
These were horrible things. This is interesting.
Yeah,
tell me more.
The roaring
Chicago.
20s, yeah.
But, no, she was the head of the county library, and they had a bookmobile, and they furnished books to a lot of the little country, you know, school libraries and stuff like that. So it was a big position. My father, when we moved there, we moved to that town because she got that job, and he got a job as a boiler servicing man or something at the hospital, and then he had a shoe store, and he got into the new stuff, which was TV. He learned to be a TV repairman and started his own business, but that meant that people would call you up just as you're sitting down to dinner, you know, and the baseball and a ball game is on and the TV has gone dead and they want you to come out and fix it right now. The
fights are on tonight.
And
he'd get up,
he'd get in his truck and he'd go over and fix it and charge him an arm and a leg, you know. And he's got tired of that, so he went to work for somebody else and just only worked during the day.
I take it you had a lot of books around the house when you were a kid?
Not too many.
Oh, really?
They did not have very... I didn't care for them too much because they had very few of them had illustrations.
Oh, yeah.
See? Usually a four-piece, you know, stuff like that. But I very few of the books do I remember them having that were interesting. They had a book on called The Barbary Coast by the guy... What's his name? The guy who wrote The Gangs of New York.
Oh, really?
And that guy... I can't remember his name right now, damn it. But he wrote about the wild days of San Francisco, which was really...
Did he make a movie about that with like Clark Gable or something like that?
It hasn't got the characters that San Francisco had at the time. Uh-huh. You know. And he wrote about New Orleans and about Chicago also.
Oh,
really?
Yeah. So he's really focused on gritty dynamics.
The early days of these cities and the stuff that went on socially. And a lot of it is the crime.
You know. Tammany Hall stuff. Yeah.
But I don't think he was always quite spot on, because I remember about New Orleans, he seemed to think that white people invented jazz.
Paul Whiteman.
It was some stuff in there that I just couldn't quite grasp, you know, but he gave credit to a white band, you know, and we're imitating, you know, all the other guys, you know. Jesus. So, you know.
What was the first... art outside of comics that you were kind of exposed to? Do you remember?
Outside of comics?
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been book illustration. And one of the first, some of the people who I liked were people who illustrated kids' books.
Like Howard Pyle.
Well, not the classics.
Like Howard Pyle.
Howard Pyle. Yeah. and also a couple others. Oh, the guy who did God's Man, Lynn Ward.
Lynn Ward.
Lynn Ward did Kidnapped and Robinson Crusoe in Pen and Ink and in Colored Washes.
Yeah.
See, and they were, those were pretty good.
The narrative,
and
too.
Yeah. Then I discovered when I got into books. And I was in my teens, so I discovered that there were, you could, you know, there were bookstores that would send out lists of interesting old books, you know, and you could get them through the mail. And I started buying stuff like that, and that's how I came across a copy of God's Man, which is, mm-hmm. you know, from
1930?
1929, 1930, that period. And it's really a graphic novel,
of course.
And that just pretty well blew me away. And I got into, like, I was interested in that kind of stuff, engraving, you know. And I did woodcuts at one time when I was studying printmaking in college, and I did that stuff.
That's what I was going to ask you. After, when did you make your first comics? Like, besides being a kid, when did that just continue, making your own comics?
I was a science fiction fan, and I got involved in science fiction fandom and fanzines, and I would do drawings for fanzines, and I started doing stories you mentioned the little single panel. It's got a picture of me walking down the street or something. That's from a story that appeared in a British fanzine.
Oh, really?
I did a lot of illustrations and stories for this one guy's fanzine because he and I had a certain rapport or something, you know. And I would use him as a character in it also. And me and my friends were all in these, and they had to do with mostly with science fiction fandom and like gags and stuff that related to that and just other stuff. And I was also, yeah, trying all kinds of inking.
Was it Flash Gordon and things like that that got you interested in science fiction, or was there certain other sort of?
What got me into science fiction was my parents. My mother insisted had me reading a dog and horse books. You know, Bob, Son of Battle.
Yeah.
After you've done, you know, a certain number of them, they get really, really sickening. You know, I needed something else. And I was in the library. You know, I always went in. I used to go in there and look at the magazines and stuff like, you know, and interesting. I found a lot of interesting stuff that way. But what it was I ran into this older girl, 3 years older than me or something, you know, but obviously, science fiction type. And she said, oh, you got to read this. And had me in Edgar Rice Burroughs. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading Edgar Rice Burroughs. And then I stepped up to Heinlein, his juveniles.
Yeah.
And then so on. And that took me into science fiction. And I started reading science fiction magazines, and they had columns in the back where they talked about fan magazines. So I started getting fan magazines.
Through the mail?
Yep.
Yep.
And then I would, you know, and that just, and I went to, when I got into the ones that were really pretty good, you know, I got into corresponding. And when I found out that there was a whole bunch of them in Berkeley, California.
Oh, close by?
Well, within hitchhiking distance.
Yeah.
See. Wow. And that would have been about, you know, 57, 58.
Wow.
And stuff like that. And I remember my first trip to Berkeley, my parents wouldn't let me go dressed as I normally would. You're going to the big city, you have to wear a suit and tie.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't let me out the door unless I fucking wore the suit and tie. So, where do I go? I go to see Dave Reich. He's the only guy who's around town. The other guys are students. And they're off somewhere. But Dave Reich lived in Trotsky Hall, it was called, because, you know, it was they were all these radical socialist people in there. If it weren't for the fact that I had a goatee, you know, they wouldn't have let a guy in a suit in the door.
Yeah.
You know, and I go up and I got the, and I got to meet Dave Reich, and he had me drawing cartoons all night, you know, for his little fanzine and stuff like that, which had things to do with Beat Generation stuff and the Beats. Mm-hmm. And we went out in the street and went around, and I picked up Beat literature, and which I was into at the time.
It's a great place for it.
Mm-hmm. And there, and met some of the, you know, local Berkeley characters and stuff.
Awesome.
So I wrote a lot of my writing and my cartooning springs from the fanzines. There was a certain style of writing, you know, in them that among them. Now I'm talking about the Berkeley people, some of the people back east, and the Irish, too.
They're very personal Brits. Stories.
Very, very, very humorous. The Irish were into a lot of humor, and so were the Brits a bit. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of that. I still have a lot of those fanzines. You know,
wasn't Phil K. Dick in the Berkeley sci-fi scene?
He was around there. I never met him until he was at a convention or something, or a party or something that I was at and he was at. But his wife, whichever one it was, turned out to be to know a lot of people in San Jose that I knew. So we just sat around and talked about people. You know, and I never talked to him. You know. But other people knew him and stuff like that. Yeah.
When was the City Lights books started?
I can't remember. They were there when I walked into that, up into North Beach, and I went in there, and I used to go in there and buy stuff. Yeah.
Ferlinghetti still works there occasionally.
He was there all
the
time.
He owns it, but he's still like not a young fellow anymore. It's been the last of it.
I lit up from Reno. I was trailed by 20 hounds. That night till the morning came around. Sit out running, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Ran into the devil, baby, and only 20 bills. Spent the night in Utah in a cave up in the hills. Sit out and run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. I ran down to the levee, but the devil caught me there. Took my $20 bill and it vanished in the air. I'm running, but take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Got two reasons why I cry awake, lonely night. The first one's named Sweet Anne-Marie, and she's my heart's delight. Second one is prison, baby, the sheriff's on my trail. And if he catches up with me, I'll spend my life in jail. Got a wife in Chino, baby, and one in Cherokee. First one says she got my child, but it don't look like me. Said I'll run, but take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
Ask about another influence. I know you're a big fan of the film festival and all that.
Yeah.
Were there movies that that really grabbed your attention? Did that influence your storytelling at all?
Eventually, yeah. Mm. At some point, it kicked into me that there's a way of telling a story that applies to what they do in the movies that you can apply to a visual novel.
Exactly.
You
know,
and stuff like that. But it took a while for that, but I can't remember when I clicked in, but I can tell you that it was a movie that it did, where that things did click. And how this movie came to be showed at my local theater, you know, in the middle of the week. It was on a double bill with two French movies. The first one was where these bunch of guys dig up this body of a naked girl who's supposed to be dead, only she's a vampire or something like that. And she's naked, but they've done something to delete the nipples. And it's just, you know, just like every time she's around, you know, yeah. it looks like they poked holes in the film or something.
Yeah, yeah,
like this.
Erased it.
And it's really weird. I couldn't even remember the story. But the second movie was called The Wages of Fear.
Uh-huh.
And I saw the shortened version of it. It's a French movie, and it's about, it takes place in this little South American country that is almost completely owned and dominated by an American oil company. And they have a fire over at one of their oil well sites over across the mountains. They need to get somebody to drive two truckloads of nitroglycerin over the mountains.
Like The Sorcerer. Is the Sorcerer a remake of that?
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
The Wages of Fear is much better.
Oh, yeah, I got to see that.
Yeah.
I love The Sorcerer.
Well, the other one, the French one, is pretty good. Mm-hmm. The two of the characters are, one is this, they don't use any of their people. They hire these layabouts, you know, these bums that are hanging out in the Mexican city.
Yeah.
See, that's where they draw from. So they get these two French guys, and one of them, he's been hanging around there for a while. You know, he's hiding out from something. His buddy shows up, and he's on the run from France. They both have some rather shady backgrounds, you see. And the other two guys are, one of them is a construction worker, and he's got cement dust in his lungs. He's going to die, so he wants to make a lot of money and go party it out. And the other guy, I'm not quite sure why, but he's Jewish, and he's very cool, and you know, and he has experience with nitroglycerin. So these guys get in these trucks, and they just, you know, big heavy trucks with these big jerry cans of nitro, and they all run into all kinds of situations, you know, like, you know, having, how do you transfer you know, nitroglycerin from the can to this, you know, with a straw, you know, little beads running down the
straw,
string,
yeah,
and stuff like that, and things happen, and one of the trucks, of course, runs into a situation and explodes. They don't show it to you. In an American movie, you'd probably see it.
Yeah,
they had. And I was really impressed with how they did it. Now, it may have been just because they didn't want to blow up the truck.
Yeah,
you know, but no, you know, you show the first two guys, the Mexican, the Latino guy, and the Jew, and the Jew is shaving, you know, as they drive along. The guy, well, how can you do that? And he says, oh, my father in the concentration camp, before they did him in, you know, he shaved, you know, like a proper man, you know, he's shaving, see? And then you cut these other guys in the truck behind the road, you know, and the one guy's the nervous, the nervous gangster guy, he's trying to roll a cigarette, you know, blast of wind blows all the tobacco right out of it, and then he looks up and you see this cloud rising up over the jungle, and then you hear the explosion.
Oh yeah!
See, and when you get there, they were going over an oil pipeline and bang something, you know, and there's nothing but a big hole in the road, and the pipeline is just pouring oil into this hole, and here by the side of the road is the handle of the razor. You know, so they got to get across that. You know, and that's, and so the driver makes the nervous guy get out, you know, and walk across there and make sure that it's not too deep. And the guy gets caught up in a tree that's underneath the surface of the oil, and the other guy will not stop, you know, because he might get stuck, and runs over him. And this great scene, he goes under with his mouth open, screaming. You know, you know, great shot. And of course, he dies, you know. And
subject matter you never get in American movies back then.
There was not an American movie. Like, yeah. When they're hiring this guy, they say, okay, don't try any funny stuff.
Yeah.
We've got our own police force. Reaches over and pulls down the Venetian blinds, and outside is this big fat Latino in a cop uniform sitting on a Harley Davidson cleaning his Smith & Wesson. You know. See? Yeah. Don't mess with the oil company. And that was, you know, don't mess
and
with the American
don't.
Oil company. Yeah. See, and that was, that made me very much aware of a lot of things, not just about movie making,
yeah.
but also about the American presence in foreign countries.
So it's a little bit political, too. You got to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, they were doing a little bit digs there, you know. And I think it was not too long after that a book called The Ugly American came out. Which
yeah, Graham Greene.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
I think so. I can't remember. I remember it. I think I even read it, but
yeah.
I don't remember it too much.
Yeah, I think it was Graham Greene.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was actually going to get to the point. We got up as far as you were like in school, I know that you served some time in the armed forces.
Yeah, that's later.
That's
see.
Later. So you went.
I
to
went straight from high school into like a 2-year, what they call it. It's a 2-year school.
Mm-hmm.
They call them junior colleges. But what it is you get most of like basic college class kind of stuff, your English requirements and your science requirements and your this and that requirements, and then you can go on to a bigger college and you can go do more upper level stuff.
Specialized.
And it was cheap and it was only 25 miles away and I could commute by bus and, you know, and stuff like that. And I took a lot of art classes there, painting and stuff. And, you know, doing that. Yeah.
Did you take any other, did you move from like painting into printmaking?
I don't think I did any printmaking there. It was I went to school for 2 years. Then I went and worked for U.S. Forestry up in the mountains, Plumas National, on disease control.
Oh, really?
We're going around. There's a disease called the blister rust that kills pine trees. Hey. And it gets from one tree to the other by way of a host plant. See, and we have to find those plants and rip them out. That's what we were doing, walking around in the forest.
That must have been pretty tedious.
I liked it.
Looking for that same plant over
there. Yeah, well, it was really hard to spot, you know.
Well, I did notice in your, like, later on when you make comics that you, ecology is one thing that actually comes up a fair amount. And that
it
was,
does?
Is that something that's...
that's much later, I would say, you know, yeah.
But you seem to really like the outdoors, though, probably, to have a job like
I spent a lot of time, you know, in the forestry. I fought forest fires, you know, and stuff like that. That was interesting. I didn't get lost. I didn't realize it that I could find my way around real easily. You know, I had been out, I've been out and around doing something. And I thought, oh, it's about time to get going home. Should I go back the way I came? Well, it's kind of roundabout, but it seems to me if I take off and I walk straight through the woods like that, I'll come out at the road. You know, I took a chance and did it, and came out, and there was the truck waiting for us.
That's a nice, nice talent to have.
Yeah, you know, I could orient myself. You know. So, even I can get lost in a really big city. That's pretty strange, you know. But I didn't, you know, my first time in Vancouver, I was with this girl, and she parked her car over somewhere in the park, you know, Stanley Park. And we walked all over the damn place, and oh God, where's my car? And I said, oh, straight through there. I walked right straight through the forest to it, you know, because I figured out where it was. You know.
So what do you think you learned in art classes that you, like, what did you most learn?
A lot of it was life drawing from life figures. Otherwise, I went to college for took a lot of different stuff, and I learned what I was not good at. I was not very good at metal sculpture, welding and stuff. I liked welding, but I didn't do anything that would work. And jewelry making, forget it.
Oh, yeah. Tedious.
No, my stuff wasn't any good. You know, I didn't have the touch.
Yeah.
You know. I did not take serigraphy, which was screen printing.
Yeah.
But I was doing screen printing on my own in my apartment in the living room. I was doing post, because there was a folk music club, and we'd get people to come in. You know, either somebody was around and we'd hear about it, we'd ask them to come, or we'd go up and get, Jesse Fuller, you know, come down, you know, some guy who lived up in Oakland, you know, all right, come on down and do a gig for us, you know, and we'd, you know, we'd charge money at the door, and I would do the posters, and I knew basically how silk screening had worked, you know, and I bought a screen, it was the right size for doing posters, and how I did it to begin with, I would do the drawing, and then I'd put it on the floor, and I'd put the screen over it, and then I would take glue, and I would
fill it in,
so it'd come out looking like a woodcut.
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Well, that's a cheap way of doing it, actually.
I didn't know any other way. I didn't know about this film, you know.
That's just cost.
Well, yeah. Well, and we, you know, just print them, you know, and run them off in my living room and hang the prints all around and stuff like that. So that was, you know, how I got into that. And then later on, I got into a place that actually did do posters and stuff like that, a screen printing shop. But that's later. Now, I ran out of money to go to college in 63, and that's when the draft caught me. And that was okay, because 63 was the worst year of my life.
You know? Oh, really?
One of those years, yeah. Well, not really the worst year. Well, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
You know, come on, you know. Yeah. It started in 62 when I moved in with this girl. You know, and
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Taking that big step. Not a lot of that kind of stuff went on. There wasn't a lot of cohabitation around too much. But I had known her for some time. There was this group of us that all... Well, in the summer of 62... Better go get that.
That's your pizza.
Pizza.
All right. Keep talking.
Yeah.
In the summer of 62, all of us who weren't working or doing anything useful, uh-huh. all in San Jose, all hung out at this one apartment. My friend and I that I've been rooming with, we knew them, you know, from the school year before. And they used to come over to our apartment to take showers away from the dorm. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
My mother came in. My mother walked in once. There's these two girls taking showers in our apartment. You know, yeah, sure, it's normal.
Yeah.
And not there was anything going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Then in that apartment, there was no privacy. And in this other one, which was their apartment, there was like a whole bunch of people sitting there.
Yeah,
yeah. It was just, you know, bodies fore and aft. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And these two guys who had just come from Egypt. They'd been over to North Africa. They'd taken for $25, they took a cattle boat over to North Africa from Georgia.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did they work on the boat on the way there?
No,
really?
Were passengers.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Eugene O'Neill used to do stuff like that, sign on to boats just to get somewhere.
Yeah. And I don't think they have any particularly fancy accommodations or anything at all. You know, it's just, you know, what... You know, but it's just, you know, yeah, you want to ride? Okay, $25.
They were all,
I remember they talked about all the old men smoked hash and all the young men only drank. They wouldn't touch hash.
Oh, really?
Stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So, there wasn't that much dope around in 62 at all. My first joint was in North Beach, in front of a jazz joint called Mr. Otis. And there's a bunch of us hanging around there. And suddenly somebody started passing this thing around, you know, and I didn't know what it was. I was waiting for it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I started toked on it, you know, stuff. But...
What year was that? That was 65 or something? 63?
No, it has to be 62.
Oh, 62?
62.
Okay.
And then when I started school in that fall of 62... the one girl, Nancy, and it must have been her initiation. We moved in together. I spent on the rent and the food and everything and so on like that. And I'd known her for some time. She's real pretty. She was smart. She was pretty popular with guys. I didn't really know her until I moved in with her.
Yeah. You never know anybody until you move in with them.
She was a compulsive liar. She could not tell the truth, really.
I know people like that. Yeah. I've met them, and it's hard.
I don't think you're welcome over here, kiddo.
Yeah.
My cat loves to be a part of the interviews.
Yeah. So you.
She was screwed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. She never really did much studying, and she had good grades, but she was just off upstairs or something. You know.
Yeah.
She would have this reoccurring nightmare that, I could tell she was having it, you know, by the way she would toss and turn and stuff. And what it was is she was in a rooming house, up on top floor of a rooming house by stairs, in a rooming house that her parents owned. And she's got a colored ball, and the ball is bouncing down the stairs to the bottom. She knows that when it hits the bottom, something terrible is going to happen to her. And there would always be somebody's name, mine or some other guy that she was, you know, having a thing
friendly
about.
With?
Let's put it that way.
Wow.
Yes. If I went away for the weekend, she'd go down to the local hangout and pick up a guitar player. But at that point, you know, it didn't bother me so much. I had become very paternal because she was, you know, there was something, you know. She was a problem. And I was very paternal about that, about stuff. But she did some really awful things that to another girl, you know, setting her up, you know, with somebody, you know, and just fucked. I don't know, she was just fucked.
Yeah.
But in the process of living with her, my grades went right down the toilet.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm studying for a final, and there's a party going on, you know, and so on. So, it did not, it just didn't compute. So, I failed a number of classes. I did. I failed. I didn't.
Because we're preoccupied.
I wasn't. Yeah. I wasn't making it with the. I wasn't studying enough. I couldn't. I went to my biology final, and it was like Greek. You know? I don't know what the fuck it was about. You know. I was hungover too.
Yeah.
See, and just you know, man.
So you like jazz music?
Okay, but I started out in Dixieland.
Oh, really?
And went into the blues and folk music, and a lot of the early folk music.
Like Langdon Hopkins sort of stuff, like that.
Reverend Gary Davis.
Oh, really?
Yep. I was big on him. There's a few other people, too, but and then the other branched out from there to other people. And on and on, and I was buying records. I'd go down to Berkeley and buy records. Vinyl, of course.
I'm standing on a corner with a dollar in my hand. I'm looking for a woman who's looking for a man. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Well, can I get you now, or must I hesitate? Oh, well, the eagle on a dollar says, in God we trust. Woman says she wants a man, but wants to see a dollar first. Tell me, how long must I hesitate? You know, can I get you now, or do I have to wait? Ain't never been to heaven, but I've been told Saint Peter taught the angels how to jelly roll. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Well, can I get you now, or must I hesitate? Oh, well, nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. I got a house full of children, not one of them mine. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Well, can I get you now, or must I hesitate? I'm standing on a corner with a dollar in my hand. I'm looking for a woman who's looking for a man. Tell me, how long do I have to wait? Well, can I get you now, or must I hesitate?
Here we are sitting with George Metzger, chatting about comics. Well, actually, we don't really talk about comics so much. More,
What goes into the comics? Is the stuff that you look at, the stuff that you hear, the stuff that you see, you know, the stuff that you do.
Stuff that you rebel against.
Yeah, yeah, you're ticked off about something, just do a story, you know. You hear somebody tells you a story, you know, at a party, steal it, go home and write it up, you know. Somebody tells you a good joke, you know. Turn it around, turn it into a little short story.
Everything's fodder.
Yeah.
Now, we were just about to get to the point where you were having some school problems. And
I flunked a lot of classes. And I didn't try really hard to get a job that summer either. And I was spending my time up in Nevada. Actually, I stuck up in Nevada. And that's where I discovered peyote and I discovered the I Ching.
Now, that was with the... I think the Russian River. Was that it?
The Russian River?
Or was
that was
later?
A folk. I went. I did some folk. That was probably, when was that? That was probably in '63 too. And there's a big folk music thing up there, big bash. And I went up there for that. And I could show you drawings of it because I got them. And I was in the army. I sat around. I drew all the stuff that happened during the summer. You know, stuff like that. But But that was just a thing that happened on a weekend. I spent numerous occasions up in Nevada there, where there's people that were into doing the peyote ceremony there at the church, and I also the people there also use the Chinese oracle, the I Ching, which is where it's got hexagrams and stuff like that. And I found that was really interesting, and I took up using that for a while. And I tried something. I asked it if it was full of shit. And by God, it gave me the right answer. I got the line, only a fool would question the accumulated wisdom of generations of wiser men than me. Something like that. But it put me in my place.
Yeah, I've never read about that, but it sounds just fascinating.
I used it off and on over the years. I was dating a Chinese girl, and it was awkward. And I asked the I Ching, if I should pursue this, and it gave me one of these things. Well, if you're prepared to climb the mountain, I said, "Oi, something like that." And said, persevere, But that's what you got to do if you're going to climb a mountain, And not with it. She was into a pyramid scam. These kind of things. She's trying to get me get into it and stuff like that too, And somewhere along the way, I did something that she didn't like, and she just gave me that, and they give you that look, and then, guess why I'm pissed at you, You have you're a man, you have no idea why, you did something, and that's it, so I chucked that one. That was the last time I think I used the I Ching with that,
So what year would have you first tried any sort of hallucinogenic?
Hallucinogenics, that's LSD.
Yeah.
That would have been probably 65 when I came back.
So that's after you tried peyote.
Yeah. Peyote, I did not have any hallucinogenic reactions to it.
Really?
You get high. Well, I didn't get enough of it. It's really hard to come by. And sometimes it's all dried up, and you have to make a tea out of it that.
Tea's
but
never
once
work.
In a, once
they
in a while, you get to the fresh buds, and stuff like that. But you'd have to do a bit. But you did get off in it. But I was doing it in a ceremony, which is a ritual, and stuff like that. And I was actually in one meeting that was quite famous at its time. This was held in somebody's apartment up on the second floor of their apartment building in Lower Berkeley. You're supposed to have a circle, but you can't have a circle in a square room, But we had we had a little fire going there, and the way things were done, it was all like sand. It all got out, got this big pile of sand, put on the floor, and we had a little fire. We had a fire going there, and we do the chants and the drumming and all this stuff. And sometime into the morning, the fire dropped through the floor. the coals. We didn't know it. The coals were done. It was all getting hot, and they just done in the whole floor, and it drops through onto the ceiling of the apartment below. Now there is nothing in the ritual's cover. The fire dropping down out of sight, because you're always doing it, in a cave or out in the desert or something like that in Nevada, all like that, No, there's nothing. Crazy, mostly white guys. So somebody had to go get a fire extinguisher and put it out, and then we, did the what you have to do in the way of a ritual, for ending everything.
Yeah.
And so on. But it was heard about and talked about all throughout the chain of people who were into stuff for some time. I heard about it later, years later, I'd hear about it. Stuff.
Guys that didn't know how to start a fire in their living.
I know how to start it. They just didn't realize that the sand is going to heat up and generate the heat right on down. Nobody thought about that. Yeah.
Did
But for the hallucinogenics, that's LSD.
Uh-huh.
And that was when I came back from the Army in '65. That's everything had changed. I knew that the changes were going on while I was in the Army. Stuff was happening.
So how did you get into the Army?
I was drafted. I didn't make enough money. I didn't make any money during the summer. I was fucking off, I was a goof, no money, so I couldn't get back into college, and right away they drafted me. I mean, it was okay.
And that was early in the draft where they're specifically pinpointing poor people in.
I don't know about which.
They weren't specifically pinpointing, but the draft committees were made of people from the rich neighborhoods. And
I don't know. I wasn't in school, so my name.
If you were married, pretty much you were exempt. If you were going to college, you were exempt. If you had like a great paying job, you were exempt, and then everybody else was screwed.
Well, when it first started, it was they would choose neighborhoods to do.
Hmm. Oh. Oh, really?
Yeah, that's why you had
gerrymandering there.
That's exactly why you have a lot of black folk that would have been.
Yeah, they would just pick a poor neighborhood.
They would go, bam, that's not our neighborhood. That's
They tried to draft me in 62 when I wasn't working. And I went up there and they wanted to investigate me because I asked this questionnaire, have you ever been involved with any of these political groups? You know, I said, oh, the IWW, the I Won't Work. Oh, yeah. Because this guy I mentioned, Dave Reich, he lived in the hall that the IWW had in Oakland. He was, like, living there, and we used to have our party. The science fiction group had their parties there. You know? And I said, oh, yeah, I knew somebody was in the IWW, you know. They couldn't take over a telephone booth, man. You know? But I had to be investigated. And so I didn't get drafted. So I went back home. We had another party, you know, because I came back. And then in 63, they drafted me. And I found out that I did not have a security clearance. I was not allowed to get near anything sensitive or something. But, but they took me up to the Air Force Base up there below little San Francisco there. The one that has a huge, enormous blimp hangar.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That you can see from the highway and up there. And the office really had these posters that said things like loose lips sink ships and all this kind of real serious 52. Stuff, you know. And, would you fight against any country, your country, any other nation that your country told you to? And it depends. You know?
Do you want an honest answer or a textbook?
Mm. Well, anyway, I didn't get I didn't have a security clearance, but that didn't matter. They asked me if I'd taken any math in college. And I said no.
What type of stuff did they get you to do?
I went to work in a finance office as a clerk, running a big machine, a big big card file that had people's names in it, you know, who traveled a lot. No big deal.
So you never got shipped overseas?
No. They were in 63, 64, they were only sending people over to Nam who were 3-year men, people who had enlisted. And if you enlist, you usually try and get a deal with them and get yourself something specific. Because they'll do that. If you want to get a certain kind of training, you want to get a certain kind of posting, you can usually work a deal with them. So, but only 3-year men were going to Nam. In 65, when I was going out, that's when the war escalated, and they were just sending people over there en masse. Yeah. If I had been in a company that was going over there and I was about to get out, they would have just shipped me right over there, and as soon as they got set up, they'd have processed me out, put me on an airplane, and shipped and sent me back to the States. Because, you know, you worked through your company. Your company processed you out. And if your company was, you know, in transit, tough shit. You know, you'd have gone over there.
You'd be there for 2 days. And
yeah, no, you know. And it happened that way. But for people who were in the Army, it was a big deal. Because if you were, you know, to get yourself over to Nam, it would usually mean, at this time in 65... one step up in rank, and you got all kinds of hazardous duty paid. You're gonna make money.
Probably get overseas paid
because this was I was on an artillery base at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and they started a searchlight battalion. This is something new. They have a searchlight battalion put around the perimeters of places, and I guess shine flashlights, you know, into the big lights. Yeah. But it was called their batteries and. In artillery talk. So this was known in locally as a flashlight battery. That's what it was called, a flashlight battery. But there were people just going like crazy to get into it, jumping into that because again, there are these guys who are like, you know, lifers. And there's guys there who aren't. Thank God there's an army to take care of people like this and tell them how to do things. You know, because these people would have been hopeless out on the streets all by themselves. You know, so good for the army. But, I was on my way out, you know, and I was getting out early to go back to college.
How long after the Army did you start getting involved back into comics?
Oh, I was already doing it. I was, my last period there, I was writing I had a sketchbook and I was writing a story in it. It subsequently formed the basis of doing later the sort of what they call that now called the steampunk stuff I was doing. I was doing that kind of period looking stuff.
I was gonna mention that because you seem to have a real love of like old motorcycles and machinery and tractors and airships. You mentioned the airship hangar they had.
I was big on airships and things like that. Right. I was doing even my early teenage. When I was a teenager, I did a story that was set in, had to do with Atlantis or something like this. Mm-hmm. And the people used gliders. They were using gliders and stuff like that made out of wood, you know, and who knows what all.
Some turn of the century type technology.
Yeah, I liked the early industrial age stuff. And I did like the big traction engines, the big steam traction engines.
My dad loves
stuff.
That stuff, too. He loves it.
Yeah. I really went gonzo when we had the expo here. And that 1 week they had a whole yard full of those things sitting around there pissing and moaning, chugging and everything.
Steam powered.
And I took a lot of pictures of those things. Yeah.
My dad loves that stuff. He made us go on vacations when I was a kid. We're going to see some steam locomotives and some steam. And I was a kid going, oh man. And my mom's like, shh. It's his vacation, so you know. But he loved that stuff. I got to ride steam trains more than I would have cared to. He loved that stuff.
It's a lost art.
Yeah. I would have loved it, but my parents would have done something like that because I would have liked that.
Yeah. Well, my grandmother used to do that too. She went down to Cottage Grove down in Oregon, so she could ride the train there because that's where they filmed The Emperor of the North with Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine, and she loved that movie. You know.
Mm-hmm. That was your old movies, Don.
Well, that was a good one. That was a pretty good one. Yeah, Ernest Borgnine puts an asshole in that one, I'll tell you.
Now. We'll be right back.
you told me before Gilbert Shelton was the one that really got you into the scene.
I had been drawing. I started drawing when comic fanzines came out, particularly Bill Spicer's graphic story thing. I started doing stories for him. I did two types. One of them was the stuff that was like Moondog. I did that. One of the other characters. I did some early stuff. My early stuff was in there. And I also did that other weird, drug-influenced stuff. Was it Master Time and Mobius Trip, which was a little trip.
Yeah.
And that stuff was... I was doing those, and I did the Moondog story for a science fiction fanzine back east, and I took a list of stuff around, and Gilbert was the guy I showed it to, and he says, well, you got enough stuff here, you can put out your own book, go to the print and talk to those guys. So I did, and I had enough stuff to do like a 24 page book, and using the Moondog story and some other short stuff, and all I needed was a cover. And I was seeing those guys, quickly. Rick Griffin, whom I really liked a lot, and I took to him a lot. Crumb wasn't around that much. Crumb liked to get away from his wife and travel, mm-hmm. and go and visit other people in other cities. So I didn't see him much, but I'd go see Griffin.
So,
and he was doing, and he told me, I said I was going to have to do a cover. And he says, well, and how you did it then was three color separation. Mm-hmm. And the process the printmint used is you do the cover front and back, usually. That's what I did. I did front and back together. And then they would have this, they'd photograph it and make three prints in blue on artboard. And then, and blue doesn't photograph. So then you'd put your Zipitone dot patterns over your artwork, see?
And then run in and three different colors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yellow, red, and blue. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and later on I did transparencies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What you got to watch out for is Moiré patterns.
Yeah, the Moiré when it looks like a.
But you can, it's a little
shimmer.
Harder when you're doing it on three different boards. But
yeah.
You just, put it over the other stuff. Figure out, but how it's gonna, what will not work, and then and make your cuts and take it and transfer it to the other one.
So did you pick the colors for a lot of your books? Did you?
Oh yeah,
color
I did
separation?
All the colors. I knew what I was wanting. I was experimenting, trying things with the color scheme.
I was going to mention that some of the colors on these covers are absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, gorgeous!
Oh no, the Ice Age one. That's killer.
The back of one of the
truckings. Yeah, it's the back of the trucking one.
There we go.
Are these ones? That's.
Oh great. Yeah,
I love that. I love the bright covers.
Well,
this is gorgeous.
Well, that's I was using graduated Zipitone.
Yeah, yeah.
I used that several times. I did it on the back of Moo too. See?
Yeah, that's nice.
Doing that one.
That's nice.
Yeah. So what? I like playing around and trying to get these certain effects.
Yeah, I like the really bright colors that are subtle. It's like a super.
Oh yeah, I was working on that.
What was the first comic?
The first one was Moondog.
It was Moondog.
Yeah, that was the Moondog number one. It's only 24 pages, and then the next one was even big. I used much more material, so it was a thicker book, And I didn't want them to raise the price. I wanted them to keep it cheap.
Did meeting other artists influence the way you worked? Like the guys like Gilbert Shelton, did they say, what are you doing? Use this, not that, don't do this?
Not too much.
Right.
Not too much. Griffin, Rick Griffin did indicate, like, when you're starting out doing these color things, just do percents over solids. Put down a solid yellow and do a percent over and stuff like that. Before you get into the complicated stuff. And I did a lot of, my first cover was a big wraparound cover, and it's very Japanese manga influenced stuff. That's the layout. It's like they like to do a big spread sometimes at the beginning of manga stories, because I was in the manga at the time. And
which types of manga were you exposed to?
I could show you. I don't know what the title is.
Yeah.
No, the one of them is called Action. So it's a thinner one. Most of them were big telephone books.
Yeah.
They came out weekly. And I was buying three weeklies every 2 weeks. That's when they came in to the store in the Japanese area. And sometimes I'd buy some of the monthly special ones too.
But you don't speak Japanese or read Japanese.
No,
you just thought they looked awesome.
Visually.
They were awesome.
Yeah.
The story, they took the time to tell a story.
Yeah.
They would like
pacing.
Do it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like slow motion stuff. The only person who did that was Kriegstein.
He would slice up the panels. I asked Al Feldstein about that, and he said, I give him the story, he'd chop it up and do whatever he wanted with it.
Yeah.
It's like, he liked playing with that.
Uh-huh. Well, And I picked that up. I also was influenced by Kurtzman's storytelling, the way he paced it, mm-hmm. the way he does three panels and something else and so on like that.
He always did those three-panel sequences.
You don't have the first Moondog here, but I
no,
should show you
the...
I think
the third and fourth.
I usually the page where like the difference kicks in, because there's a page in there where I'd stop. And when I resumed the story, I discovered the manga. And I was, you know, everything was different.
Now when you make comics, what was your process like? Would you like write out a story completely before you would start drawing?
Sometimes.
Would you just go right in?
Sometimes I just get started. I had an idea where I was going, and I just get started. But sometimes sometimes the story writes itself too.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them later on, I would try and get the whole thing down and plan it out. Mm-hmm. Because like for Moo, I had it all planned out in a little booklet ahead of time. Because I wanted to do things like splash pages. I wanted to have panels that ran off the page.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one time I was told, you can't do that. You know, printers don't like that. Don't do it. You know, but they did it in the Japanese comics all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out by talking to a printer why. Because they don't want stuff to go out too far to the margins, because, you know, they've got these little, on the press, they've got these little fingers to come out and they grab the edge of the sheet of the paper and they pull it out and drop it into the tray, you know? And if you get ink on them, pretty soon you've got ink everywhere. So I said, it's real simple. These things get trimmed.
Yeah.
And I find out where the trim line is.
There you go.
You know, and I just draw a hair past the trim line. Uh-huh. You know? And I have to know where the centerfold is because I might, you know, so that means I know, is this going to be a left-hand page or a right-hand page?
Mm-hmm.
And design accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So I could do effects like that.
Yeah. Yeah, Neil Adams said he had the same problem when he first started working at DC. I can't remember his name. Jack Adler was the art director there. He did all the production, and he said, "Do you think we can run this as just a color tone for a cover or whatever?" And he goes, They always tell me they don't want to. And he goes, "Yeah, but I want that." And he goes, "Let's do it then." He would just try anything.
Mm.
He goes, "Can we do this? Can we do that?" And he goes, "Well, we normally don't, but I don't see any reason why we can't."
Yeah.
He said it was the best guy he ever worked with, because he'd go, "Come in here, let's," you know, and then they play around with something.
Mm.
And it was almost a learning experience.
Mm. No, all this was a learning experience for me. Yeah, I'd try stuff. And maybe I'd remember what I was trying, you know, when I finally saw print and so on like that.
Your stuff is pretty different from the rest of the underground stuff.
I was a little bit older than those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I had a different influences too, probably. You know, I'd read an awful lot of stuff over the years, and stuck my nose into a lot of different illustrators and so on. So did some of them, and some of them, this was all new to them.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, and so on. But like that, this Ice Age thing, the thing that kicked that off was I read a newspaper article by two scientists, Canadian scientists, who talked about how, you know, an Ice Age might happen. And it had to do with and I write it in the story, you know, stole it from these guys.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember their name, but they're Canadians. And but there was a lot of different stuff going on around that,
mm-hmm.
Talking about, you know, climate change. And what was happening, it was hard to find any data, you know, that was really nailed anything,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I took these guys, and I said, this is an interesting theory, and it has to do with the fact that you lose, you know, all that ice on around in the north, up north.
It evaporates.
It reflects the light back.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
See, now when you got an open sea, it's going to be absorbed. And you're going to have different atmospheric things happen. You're eventually, the air is going to be moister up in the north. And eventually it's going to come and it's going to just start dropping, you know, precipitation all over the north.
Oh, really?
That was their theory.
So you just extrapolated on that and
mm-hmm.
did up a story?
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that like when you were like getting ready for printing or whatever, you would pay attention to like which pages would be facing each other. Was
mm-hmm.
that something that
yeah.
you consciously were aware of?
I was aware of, yes. You know, because look at continued strips. Like I was a Buck Rogers fan,
mm-hmm.
and every Sunday it had a cliffhanger ending,
mm-hmm.
and so I would design my pages that way sometimes if I could. You know, I do not want to have something that runs over and on to the next page. It's like writing music. You got to know, you know, the beat.
A beat, yeah.
And stuff like that. So, you know.
that Carl Barks would do that. He said every page he had some sort of punchline and left you wanting to see the next page. It was like a beat.
But it was on an upbeat, and you have to, and then you go to the next page. It's different, you know, stuff like that. I did things that were paid. There's that Mal Ng strip that was in Yellow Dog. That's structured differently too, because there's two pages that are, you're in a biological environment, claustrophobic, you know, like it's before birth. And then when they come out of it, they're in this big open, you know, environment. Lots of sky, lots of big panels and stuff like that. And then they're
very Japanese.
Yeah, and they influenced me a lot. Yes, and the third final page. And these were like facing pages. And the fifth page was where they go through the door, and there's all these planets and stuff, and in space and stuff. So it was even different. Yeah,
I noticed that Keith, you use inside the back cover as part of the story too. That's
well,
that
sometimes, yeah. You know, I got it. What am I going to put there? You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. Like, yeah, there are times when it works that way.
Yeah.
Only once I really deliberately designed it that way, and that was for a nonverbal story that ran in Bill Spicer's magazine. And
I think that's the one I have that has like the Earth,
the planet.
Yeah, the planet. The
planet with the clouds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The spaceship, and you close, and it's all truck ins. It's like a camera move. You truck in, you keep going in, and until the end, you come upon these guys, these aliens in like a little library or something like that, and what they're looking at is the magazine that the story is in, and it closes in on that, you know, and the back page
is that,
and then you know, and then the back cover was, you know, the spaceship stuff like this right from the front.
Yeah, that worked really cool. That was, I wish I would have bought it tonight. I'm sure Robbie,
a little Mobius loop.
Yeah.
One quote I got talking to one underground artist, I'll leave him anonymous for now. He said, "He was always really healthy." In context to you,
really?
Chopping wood.
Yeah, there's that. Depends on when he knew me. When I was, I
think this is in San Francisco.
Well, I guess I was. I was reasonably healthy, but I used to have. What was it? I remember when I was in the army. I had a cold all the time because you're living in a barracks with other people.
Yeah,
and when I leave and go on leave, it went away, and I go back. You know, and sometimes living with in communally in students, I had colds a lot, I know. But when I was living more on my own or just with one other person, it wasn't so bad.
Same, my job was like that. I was with people every day in a band, and I would be sick all the time.
Yeah.
And now I haven't been sick in about 2 years, except for. One thing I was going to ask you about is how did you end up in Canada?
Oh, it's really simple. I've been living in San Jose for about 4 years or something. I was working as a screen printer, drawing comics at night, and so on. I was getting a little tired of it. I wanted to get out of it, and I wanted to really just draw comics full time, just to do it, to really, you know, let it out. And these friends of mine, quite a few friends, had come up here to the Spokane Valley and bought land. And some of them were really close friends of mine. One couple. In fact, I introduced the girl to the guy, and she married him. And so, and he was a cartoonist, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. His name is Bob Inwood. He did some comics, too. And, but he was also a Harryhausen freak, and he had made a movie, trying to emulate, humans and you know, running the film back and then doing the pterodactyl, fighting with this guy and stuff like this. And he got a job with some guy out in the valley. He got in to become a citizen, because of this guy who's an artist who worked out there, was into something like that. And so there's some sort of a connection there that his film got him into the country. And he got land. He had a bunch of drug money. Or, well, a lot of these people who were coming up here, Americans, had drug money to buy land. And land was cheap
to buy up here,
It was really cheap out there. It's all Dukabor country, see?
Yeah.
And the kids didn't want to become farmers. They wanted to get,
they wanted the city. And you didn't want the city.
I didn't want the city. I wanted, And I had a Chevy one-ton panel truck. It's in trucking there. You can see it. And, where is it? Oh, it's not in this issue. This is the older van, the older truck. But the first issue is what you need. But
if you can find a copy. I had to find mine in an obscure little store in Portland.
Right inside the front door.
Yeah. Well, this is where I was. This is where I went. And those are my friends. And this is the Slocan Valley in the... There's the truck and all that. And the truck is in the story several times. And this is all mostly autobiographical.
And that's your boy in the back of the truck?
No.
No?
No. Too old. Anybody in the back of the... No, I didn't. I was...
I thought there's one part where there's a kid in the back of the truck.
Unless it's me. Now, it depends on what I'd have to see it. But no, it's autobiographical. This is like 71 or 70, 71 okay. when I came up here. And I stayed with these one people and helped them, you know, on their... They had 36 acres, which they got for $12,000. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it went straight uphill. But mind you, the part of it went down to the river and so on like that. It was on a back road there, you know, in a place called Windwall. It was old, and it had an old Dukabor house there. And had a meadow on one side and a meadow on the other. And a garden, and an outhouse, you know, and water, and electricity. And we'd draw comics in the evening, and work in the garden, and do whatever we had to do, you know, around the place to get it going, because, you know, it took a lot of work. He was not a country boy. His girlfriend was from up north where I live. She grew up on a farm, so she had a little more smarts about things than he did. And he didn't know stuff, see. So he had a little patch of stuff growing up on the hillside up there among the trees, you know. And there's this one tree was blocking the sunlight. So I'm going to chop it down. So he takes an axe and starts whacking away at it. I said, hey, it's not the way, you know. I learned how to drop trees in the forestry, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, there's the old-fashioned way where you make the big cut and you back up to it, put a thumb in each corner and look straight ahead, and that's where the tree's going to go. You know, that hangs up.
Yeah.
But he didn't know. He just started cutting. And, of course, I got out of the way.
Lo and behold.
Yeah, I go way out of the way. But sure, yeah. Okay. And when it starts toppling the wrong way, he tries to push it back. You know,
oh, yeah, he's pushing it back.
And it dropped, of course,
5,000-pound tree.
Right down on the dope patch.
Yeah. That's what you get for being not listening.
But since he had planted the plants, you know, irregularly, you know, in little places where you could get soil in among the rocks, not a one of them was touched. There's branches all among them, but not a one of them was touched.
Oh, really?
It was just a little objective lesson from the universe.
Yeah, yeah. We'll give you this one. The next one's ours.
He wouldn't listen to me, you know, because, hey, he'd been there for, like, you know, almost a year.
He knows it all.
You know, and I don't, you know. I dropped trees, and you know, so we cut it up, you know, took a lot of work, you know, cut all the branches off and then saw the damn thing up and haul it down, and, you know.
When did you move to Canada permanently?
The next year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I went back down south for the winter and I was just hanging around mainly and drawing comics. I was sharing an apartment with some guy and acquired a girlfriend and stuff like that. So it might be a pretty good deal to stay, but no, I wanted to go back for the summer. My plan had been, I'm going to spend my summers in Canada and my winters in California. Yeah, because when I left, I left with winter was well on. You know, it was cold. And I went to Boise, Idaho, because I had friends living there.
Yeah, and I noticed in your book it lists like Portland and Moscow. Well, I love Moscow. I've been to Moscow 50 times.
Yeah, well, there's that. That Idaho hippie.
Yeah,
this is real. This is a real
with the
place.
House building the house.
That's
yeah,
real.
Yeah,
there. I went out there, and
was that by Boise?
This is on side of Moscow. Moscow,
oh, okay,
Idaho.
Yeah, I love Moscow.
Out there, and there's the guy. The guy who designed it was an architectural student, a dropout, and he didn't have any plans written down. Everything was in his head. And this thing was on the other side of a ravine, up on a little hillside, and it looks like the way you see it. This shot up here, mm-hmm. I was up on the roof up there doing shingling, and that's the way everything was.
Oh, really?
There was this one part over here, one room. The wall would be curved because he curved that part of the building, and there's all this stuff here. That's
oh, really?
The way it was. That's the heater they had. They don't look like that.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't draw them, but I drew the location and the way it was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And and of course the joke, I'd seen a single panel cartoon someplace that had that gag, and I just built it into the story, you know. Yeah. Now when I showed it to these guys, they thought it was hysterically funny. But when I showed it to the girl whose apartment I was staying in, she didn't get it.
She didn't.
You know, cause
that was it. It was over.
No, it wasn't. She just didn't get it. It's, you know, it's just out of her world, you know. And most guys would get it, you know, especially if they've done any kind of
construction,
you know, having to deal with stuff, you know.
About a maid, I'll sing a song, sing rickety tickety tin. About a maid, I'll sing a song, who didn't have her family long. Not only did she do them wrong, she did every one of them in. She did every one of them in. One morning in a fit of pique, sing rickety tickety tin. One morning in a fit of pique, she drowned her father in the creek. The water tasted bad for a week, and we had to make do with gin, with gin. We had to make do with gin. Her mother, she could never stand, sing rickety tickety tin. Her mother, she could never stand, and so a cyanide soup she planned. The mother died with a spoon in her hand, and her face in a hideous grin, a grin. Her face in a hideous grin. She set her sister's hair on fire, rickety tickety tin. She set her sister's hair on fire, and as the smoke and flame rose higher, danced around the funeral pyre, playing a violin, olin, playing a violin. She weighted her brother down with stones, rickety tickety tin. She weighted her brother down with stones and sent him off to Davy Jones. All they ever found were some bones and occasional pieces of skin, of skin. Occasional pieces of skin. One day when she had nothing to do, rickety tickety tin. One day when she had nothing to do, she cut her baby brother in two and served him up as an Irish stew and invited the neighbors in, boys in. Invited the neighbors in. And when at last the police came by, rickety tickety tin. And when at last the police came by, her little pranks she did not deny. To do so she would have had to lie, and lying she knew was a sin, a sin. Lying she knew was a sin. My tragic tale I won't prolong, rickety tickety tin. My tragic tale I won't prolong, and if you do not enjoy my song, you've yourselves to blame if it's too long. You should never have let me begin, begin. You should never have let me begin. Gin, we had to make do with gin. Her mother, she could never stand, sing rickety tickety tin. Her mother, she could never stand, and so a cyanide soup she planned. The mother died with a spoon in her hand, and her face in a hideous grin, a grin. Her face in a hideous grin. She set her sister's hair on fire, a rickety tickety tin. She set her sister's hair on fire, and as the smoke and flame rose higher, danced around the funeral pyre, playing a violin, olin, playing a violin. She weighted her brother down with stones, a rickety tickety tin. She weighted her brother down with stones and sent him off to Davy Jones. All they ever found were some bones and occasional pieces of skin, of skin. Occasional pieces of skin. One day when she had nothing to do, sing rickety tickety tin. One day when she had nothing to do, she cut her baby brother in two and served him up as an Irish stew and and invited the neighbors in. Neighbors in. Invited the neighbors in. And when at last the police came by, sing rickety-tickety-tin. And when at last the police came by, her little pranks she did not deny. To do so she would have had to lie. And lying she knew was a sin, a sin. Lying she knew was a sin. My tragic tale I won't prolong, rickety-tickety-tin. My tragic tale I won't prolong. And if you do not enjoy my song, you've yourselves to blame if it's too long. You should never have let me begin, begin. You should never have let me begin.
That was an interview with local Vancouver comics legend George Metzger. Check out his stuff. Google him. You won't find much, but it's good. Moo, Truckin', as well as Moondog, and some other titles were stuff he was involved in back in the 60s and 70s. They're great stuff. You can find part two of this interview on inksuds.com. And stay tuned for The French Connection, and next week I'll be featuring an interview with Christopher Forges, a.k.a. CF.